Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, September 10th, 2018, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I apologize for my voice here in the intro. I just got back from Dragon Con with the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and picked up a little bit of con crud, as they call it. It's the best part of a convention, isn't it? Oh, yes, indeedy. All right, but don't you worry, because this episode was recorded before I left, so I've got plenty of pep during the episode. Now, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that is mostly thanks to the support from incredible people like you. So this week's top patrons, they pledged their support by going to patreon.com/talknerdy. They include Rob Shrek, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil Tiber, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jeromio Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and last but not least, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys all so much from the bottom of my heart. All right, I say we just get right to it. This week is a really fun episode. I have the chance to sit down with Sarah McSorley of Super Cool Scientist. She is the project director, writer, and entrepreneur and CEO of Super Cool Scientist, which is an organization working to promote inclusion in science, tech, engineering, and math, you know, good old STEM. In 2017, I think it was 2017 when she first published. I could be wrong. It may have been 2016. But anyway, she published a really cool coloring book called Super Cool Scientist, which really has a goal of making sure that the stories are relatable and that they show important representation within the sciences so that young people, and I think older people alike, are inspired by their stories. So we're going to talk all about the book and about her work. So yeah, without any further ado, here she is, Sarah McSorley. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So we are going to talk about your work in SciComm, including actually two books. You've got one book out called Super Cool Scientists, a coloring book celebrating women in science. That's written by you and also illustrated by Yvonne Page. But you are just coming out with your second, I guess, installment in this series. And what is that one called?
So the second one is Super Cool Scientists number 2, a story and coloring book celebrating today's women in science. And that's also written by me and illustrated by Yvonne again.
Cool. So the difference there is that it's kind of more of a focus on modern women scientists.
So both of them are women who are currently doing the work. Part of it was just really trying to come up with a tagline that caught some different people this time around. And it's just a different cohort of women who we feature in the second book, including some STEM fields that we didn't get to include in the first one.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, you're right. As I'm flipping through, I'm realizing that, yeah, many of these women are either quite young or are definitely, I guess all of them are still very active within their respective fields. And of course, there's some names that I recognize who I really look up to, like Sylvia Earle. I was lucky enough to be able to host a National Geographic Explorer Festival earlier this year. And at the award ceremony, she was given a big award by National Geographic because of all the incredible work that she's done. Oh, and I see Maria Mayer. I love her. She's so great. Pink Boots and Machete.
Yeah, that's right.
Very cool. Oh, yeah.
Yep. So with the first one, you know, a lot of trying to figure out who I wanted in it was sort of me thinking through some of the people who I looked up to when I was sort of pursuing my own science career path before that shifted a little bit. And Dr. Earle and Mayor were two of those people. So it was pretty exciting to actually have them sign on to be a part of it.
Oh, yeah, that's super cool. And Danielle Lee is in here, too. Oh, some of the good people. Oh, that's so great. And so were your choices really based on, like, you know, you didn't have to go looking. These were people who had already really heavily influenced you.
So it was a mix. I think with the first book, especially, it was a mix of either people that I sort of knew and looked up to or people who I had read about, just sort of following a lot of diversity in STEM and science communication work, or I was looking for people who worked in certain fields. And so it was based on some just research directly, or one of my jobs relatively recently was working in Rhode Island on a statewide project that was an NSF program. So had a national group that we would meet with as well. So I was in touch with a lot of those people who were doing different STEM projects in their states, where I was able to say, hey, I'm looking for someone who does this kind of work. Do you know any women who might be interested? So I was able to get connected to some of the folks that way. So it was really a mix on how the different people got involved.
Very cool. And so let's talk a little bit about kind of your work leading up to doing this project, because obviously you are STEM enthusiastic. Are you also heavily involved in STEM?
So that's been a journey, not exactly a straight line career, right? But my background and training is in marine biology, hence the Sylvia Earle kind of connection there. So that's what I went to school to study, thinking I wanted to be a researcher, but had never had a research project until my junior year of college. And then I realized I really wasn't that into it. And at the time, nobody had said, oh, this is all the other stuff you can do with a science degree. Like, I thought research was my only option. So luckily, I had some really fantastic mentors who were able to show me there are all these other things you can do, like the science outreach and communication and education. So I got more onto sort of that kind of a track and exposed to more of that kind of work. So I got into a lot more science outreach and education stuff when I graduated and started working with this project in Rhode Island. It was called the EPSCoR program, Experimental Program to Stimulate Competitive Research. And basically, it's a National Science Foundation project that goes to states who have traditionally not gotten that much research funding. And they're trying to focus on a STEM area to really sort of advance their state. So in Rhode Island, it was marine science. And at the time, they were like, oh, we need someone to do our newsletter. I was like, oh, great, I can do that, right? So that's what they hired me for the more outreach piece. And but it was connecting. We worked with all 9 different colleges in the state, and there were 3 different research centers and a huge undergraduate student research program over the summers. So it was this really large project. And over time, I started doing more of their project administration work as I moved my way up there. So I was actually sort of overseeing a lot of the full $20 million project by the end of my time there, which was pretty amazing. And then I moved to Connecticut and started running a university-based community center that was a teaching and learning center for kids and educators. So we did a big after-school program, and that was much more arts-based, and then teacher professional development programs that were more math and science-based. But I had kind of gotten further away from the science in my day-to-day work, that and I missed it. So I was looking for some sort of a side project to bring some of that sort of science enthusiasm back into my life. So I was kind of had my eyes open for a project that I could be working on. And at the same time, kind of on a parallel track, I was trying to figure out some things that helped with some of my own stress and anxiety issues I was having at the time, and sort of fell into discovering the coloring part. It was right before the adult coloring craze kind of kicked off. And right. And realized that was something that helped calm me down a little bit. So I was looking for books that I'd want to color myself. You know, so I was in Google looking for, oh, let's look up a women in science coloring book. That would be cool. And nothing came up. So I was like, wait a minute, that never happens. Maybe this is my idea. Like it would sort of do a bunch of these things at once. And then so the whole idea was totally new. I'd never written a book. I funded the first one with a Kickstarter campaign. I had never done anything like that. So just kind of decided it was an important project. It was something that would do what I was looking for personally at the time. And that I was going to dive in and figure it out as I went. And it's been a pretty incredible experience.
So when exactly did you kind of start on that path on developing the books and starting to kind of create this this really cool piece of art that you're able to share with so many people?
Yeah, so the original book was published in January 2017. And the whole process of actually deciding to jump in and launch the Kickstarter was about a year before that, because it took us about a year from idea to publication.
And is your Kickstarter still going on? I guess Kickstarter is kind of different than Patreon in that they are targeted campaigns. They're not really ongoing, are they?
Right. It was just sort of a one-time. They usually run between a month and 2 months. That was just at the beginning, just to fund the first one. And for these, mostly expenses is to pay the illustrator because she's so fantastic. Wanted to make sure that she got the value that she was bringing to the project. So that first one was really to fund those expenses, but also to sort of start to build a following around the books. So that Kickstarter campaign was a lot of fun because it was sort of how I got to start building our social media following on Facebook and on Twitter and really start to get some other people paying attention to the project beyond the direct people that I knew in my own networks.
Gotcha. And so you said that was at the beginning of last year. I'm trying to like remember what year we're in right now. Yes, yeah, so it is already late 2018. Can you believe that?
Right.
That
so no, I can't.
And so the second book, when did you decide, okay, I had so much fun with the first one, let's go ahead and make another one?
It wasn't that long after the first one published. So it was one of those things, like the feedback from it was so good. And I think my favorite part of the whole project is really getting to interact with the people I meet, whether it's the people who are featured in the book itself or the people who reach out and want to do events or order bulk orders for their school projects. Sort of those connections are just really energizing for me. And so I was like, oh, let's think about doing another one. And I was, you know, talked to the illustrator to make sure she was on board with that. And we decided to do another one. And it's taken us about a year to put this one together as well.
Gosh, it must have been so exciting too. I mean, I feel like crowdfunding is always such a double-edged sword. It's so exciting and it's such an wonderful opportunity for so many content creators. You know, I use crowdfunding with Talk Nerdy. I'm on Patreon. Mm-hmm. And it's a big part of this fraction of my income, right? Like I wear a lot of hats. I do a lot of jobs. But when it comes to podcasting, about half my income as a podcaster, half of the revenue that I make that goes back into paying my assistant and paying my editors and you know, buying equipment and all that kind of stuff. Half of it comes from Patreon and half of it comes from ad sales. But there's always such a gamble, right? That you're going to put yourself out there and you're going to say, hey, this is this really cool thing I want to do. I hope you believe in it too. And sometimes people overwhelmingly respond positively. And sometimes people are like, yeah, not that into it. And so when you did your Kickstarter campaign for Super Cool Scientists, you know, you met and exceeded your goal. That must have been a really exciting feeling.
Yeah, it was. And I think especially, like you said, because a lot like with Kickstarter, specifically with this project and for a lot of others that I've seen, you're pitching an idea for something. Like it's not something that exists yet, right? So you're trying to get the funding to produce something. So it's even more, you know, kind of more complicated because you're like, well, I'm asking you to fund this idea for something that doesn't exist yet and to trust me enough to use your money to create it. And it was interesting too, because, you know, at the time, a lot of my past professional work has been grant writing. So like I basically ask for money for a living, but for asking for money for something that was my project felt a lot more personal, I guess. So it was a little different to put it out there, but getting so much of a response, especially from people who weren't people I knew or, you know, friends of friends, really helped validate the idea behind the project, right? I was like, if so many people from so many different places think this is a good idea, like I made the right decision to follow through on this project. But you're right, it involves so many different components, because I also tried to do one for the second book where I felt like I was going to be more successful because I already had the first book to point to. So I could say, you know, there's an already existing thing, we want to expand it. And then I also paid a college student that time around to help me make the video that goes with it, because the first time it was a very basic video that I made for the first one. So the second one, I'm like, oh, great, I'm going to be able to do all this great stuff with this video that was made. But that one wasn't successful for the second time around. And I think a lot of that came to down to the time that I actually got to put in it, because you do set it for a certain amount of time. Once you put the time frame on it, you can't change the dates for Kickstarter. So, and I had once I had already hit the go button, a couple sort of serious transitions started to move for me both professionally and personally. So I just didn't have as much time to put put into the promotion of it as I did with the first one. So I think that's really what it comes down to, too, is you still have to really make sure it's getting into people's, you know, line of sight, because just because you put it out there doesn't mean people are going to find it and fund it just because it's a good idea.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that really is the case with any sort of content creation, with any sort of small startup. I mean, I definitely know this firsthand working with Jason Goldman and Sarah Curtis on SciComm Camp. We're coming into our fourth year of SciComm Camp, and it's such an exciting experience. And, you know, we generally do kind of fill up after our first year. We got big enough that we had to change venues. But that said, there's always this like multiple month period of holding our breath before camp actually starts, where we don't know if we're going to get the people to sign up. We don't know if, you know, enough people are going to come that this becomes a cost-effective endeavor, because, you know, there's always that kind of threshold, right? Whether it's right. publishing a book or doing a professional development retreat where, you know, under a certain number of people, you actually lose money on it. And after That's a certain right. point, you break even and you're like, okay, whoo, okay, I'm not like so out on a limb and I'm, you know, that my own money is really being heavily gambled here. And it's tough. It's a big proposition that we're sort of gambling on.
Yeah, it's true. So with these, you know, when I published the first one, I wasn't sure how successful it was going to be. So it was just more of a side thing to just kind of test it. But since seeing how popular it's been, like I've turned it into an LLC. So it's technically a small business to do the second one and have separated out all the bank accounts and all of that stuff. So it does feel, I don't know, it feels a little more legit now, I guess. I mean, it certainly was before too, but now that it's sort of its own entity, it kind of helps, I think, sort of me separate it from my own stuff that I'm doing.
Yeah, that definitely helps. And it's something that we talk about sometimes at SciComm Camp. We do one breakout group called the Freelancers Support Group. And people kind of, you know, they bring their concerns and their issues, but also their solutions to problems. Because a lot of times these science content creators and SciCommers in general, we're sort of, I don't want to say we're working in a vacuum because we have all sorts of amazing support in social media. But, you know, it's like somebody will feel like I'm the one at my university, or, you know, especially if you're like a public information officer or something, or I may maybe know two other content creators in my hometown, or not even any other content creators in my hometown. And so you sometimes feel a bit like you're swimming upstream, like you're kind of on your own. And it's really great when you can get together with other SciCommers and see like, oh, how do you do that? How do you deal with that? And things like starting a business, incorporating, you know, filing your paperwork with the Secretary of State. And is it worth it to pay the $800 that you have to pay in California in order to be incorporated? And is it worth it to separate all of that out and start a separate bank account? And you right. know, those are like important questions that I don't think most everybody is in a position to have immediate answers to. I'm lucky I live in LA, so it's like the land of freelancers.
Right.
So I'm able to pick the brains of a lot of the people around me. And now I've been doing it for a long time, but not everybody has that opportunity. And don't you feel like more and more young people are having to have non-traditional kind of self-employment gumption because there just aren't the stable, long-term corporate jobs available that sort of our parents used to have?
I feel like that's true, or at least people are, you know, they're switching what they're doing more often, whereas, you know, maybe our parents' generation was more like they had just one or two jobs or was with one or two companies. And yeah. now that changes a lot more. And I feel like a lot of times too, kind of like what this was for me, where if the day job isn't sort of fulfilling completely in what I was looking for, I felt like I needed something else to do that. So that's part of why this started for me. Like, I still got a lot of things out of my day job, and I'm glad that I had it. But at the same time, like, I felt like something was missing. So I just kind of created it myself. And I feel like we see a lot more of that. Well, if this doesn't exist, or if I'm not getting this out of what I'm doing, then I'm just going to do it on my own. I feel like we see more of that from not just young people, but sort of older people, too.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And I hate to come across as like ageist when I say that, but you're so right. It's just kind of the time that we live in where production is sort of democratized. There's so many ways to DIY things and to get them mm-hmm. available to the general public, which is great. And also, you know, your hobby doesn't have to cost you money. It can, but your hobby can also potentially make you money. Like, there are ways to market those things, and what a great opportunity to be able to have both. Some people like to keep it separate, though. They're like, I don't want to attempt to make this into a business because it sucks all the joy out of it. And other people are like, hey, if I can break even or make a little bit of extra money, that makes my hobby that much better.
Right. And I think for me, it was more of just sort of a, not so much a separation of, oh, I want this to make money. I feel like it just kept keep my books cleaner. I'm kind of a type A kind of personality when it comes to stuff like that. So
QuickBooks neurotic.
Yep. It was helpful to keep all that separate. And it's, it's been successful, but sort of the way that I define that is once I broke even, I haven't had to dip into my own pocket to cover any expenses again. Since the Kickstarter for book two wasn't successful, I was able to pay for all the expenses of the second project with what I sold of the first project. So I figure, if I can keep doing that, if it does more than that, that's great. But if it does just enough to continue doing this kind of a project, then that's what I define it as successful for me.
Oh, absolutely. And like, let's be clear, right? Because I think that this is a really inspirational story that hopefully people who are listening right now, who maybe have been on the fence about moving forward with their own endeavors, will be motivated listening to this story. Like, you were not somebody who is deeply entrenched in the publishing world. You were not somebody who had, an angel investor or who had already been working in this field. This was an idea you had, and you worked really hard to make it come to fruition.
Yeah. And it's something I did in addition to my day job, right? So it's not something I had full-time hours every week to dedicate to either. So it's sort of, you have to find the time management piece. And then at this point right now, as of the end of June, I've decided to really just focus on this for a little while, which is also incredibly scary because I've always been a more traditional 9-to-5 regular job, health insurance kind of person. And right now I'm not doing that, which is slightly terrifying. but I figured I have the opportunity to try that a little bit for a few months, and I'm going to do it because so far it's been something that's kind of given me all the data points to tell me that that's a good idea. But I think you have to kind of weigh your own situation. But I think if there's something you've been on the fence on, there are so many ways to create your own thing these days. Like, these books are self-published, but the response that they've gotten is just so incredible. Like, and there's so many ways to gauge whether or not there's interest in what you're doing. So you can sort of put the idea for something out there before risking a whole lot too. So you can kind of dabble and see kind of what the response is going to be to your projects as well, which is really great.
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, we're living in a time where we're definitely empowered to be able to dream it and do it and even potentially turn it into our career, and it doesn't always work for everybody. And I think that you're right. Like, we shouldn't be lofty about it, but we should definitely be responsible about it. And if there's a plan in place and you make a budget and you figure out what your necessary parameters are, I think that it's not out of reach for most people to be able to utilize the tools that are available, whether it's Kickstarter or Patreon or, Amazon or all these different, or YouTube, all these different platforms. And really just, I think making a budget is probably the most important thing. It's like, let's look at the data, right? Let's be scientists about this.
And right.
Look at the data.
And remembering that things come up that are surprises, right? So sort of always leaving you have a little extra set aside for those surprises too in your budget. Because that's always something that comes up. But I think, that whole thing, sort of me coming up with the idea and really deciding to do it in the first place, where I had never done a book or anything like this. Like, I've always enjoyed writing. I've always done a lot of that sort of in my professional roles. I've got a master's in business. Like, I have all these things where, like, I should have felt totally capable in doing it, but I didn't right away. It kind of took me a while to believe that it was something I could do too. But part of my thought process in that was like, well, there are a ton of people out there every day who do this. Like, they can do it. Why can't I? But it almost like it took me a while to convince myself that even though I hadn't done it before, it was something that I could do. But sort of once I got moving on it, and again, sort of having other folks validate the idea and then the product itself when it came out, I was like, oh yeah, like there was no reason I should have doubted myself in the first place. Like that was all in my head.
Gosh, isn't it true that so much of it is in our heads? You know, so much of the stuff that keeps us from like fulfilling our potential just really comes down to, you know, all the things that we're used to talking about in sort of science and psychology. It's, you know, imposter syndrome. It's just concerns about, you know, maybe stereotype threat, all these different reasons that we think we can't because we didn't have good role models or because we weren't trained in that area or because of our background, we didn't see that that was an option for us. I mean, I see it all the time in young women, in people of color, especially that just the idea of going into science doesn't seem like an option because, you know, you grow up and you've never seen another scientist who looks like you and you think, oh, that's for like the upper echelon, that's for the elite, or that's for like the old white men who have access to all of these opportunities. And it's just, oh gosh, it just crushes me when I think about the way that our society has been structured for so long.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, sort of that whole imposter syndrome piece sometimes is almost a theme in the interviews I have with the women in the book, whether it's something that makes it into their one page bio or not. I mean, that's one of the things that quite a few of them talk about at some point throughout their career. And really with the sort of seeing someone who looks like you, that was part of why I thought this project was so important too. Like the goal from the very beginning was to have any person who picks up this book or either one of the books find something that they can feel connected to in one of these stories, whether that's through the narrative itself or the illustration and what the person looks like. And the stories, you know, it's not just about what these people do for their STEM job and kind of what that looks like day to day, but also, you know, what their families were like growing up and what they like to do for fun as kids, what kind of stuff they were interested in, what they do now outside of work with their friends, and sort of this whole picture of these individuals as a full person. You know, it's not just about what they do at work, but, you know, someone could read it and be like, oh, well, I really enjoyed making mud pies in my backyard too. Like, you know, maybe I have something in common with this person. It's a, sort of trying to provide a, as many touch points as possible that people can connect to.
Oh gosh. And that's just so important too, for I think sort of defining, or maybe I should say presenting what it means to be a real human being. Because so often I think, especially women in science are brought to this standard because of the inequity within the field, and really the inequity within most professional fields, especially at the highest levels. But there's always this concern, right, as women or as people of color, of being represented as a token. This is something that I think a lot of people really try to fight against, and how important it is to show that individuals who happen to work as scientists are not just like scientists all day long, every day, that that's not their only defining feature. That of course, yes, many people take pride in their work and they're like, yes, I'm a scientist and I'm proud to be a scientist, but also maybe she's a mom. Maybe she's not a mom. Maybe she loves her dog. Maybe she's an adventure traveler or an amateur photographer or a surfer, or, you know, all these other things that really are definitive of who we are as whole human beings.
Right. And I think that that's so important to show because, you know, none of us are just what our day job is. And some of that other stuff is the things that make us really interesting, too.
Absolutely. So I hate to do this because I feel like I'm co-opting the interview a little bit to plug SciComm Camp, but I just kind of realized that I feel like our interview especially is such a good representation of why I and my co-founder started SciComm Camp, and I never talk about it on the show, I realized, because I don't know why. The show is so pointed. Like last week, I was interviewing somebody all about beavers, you know, and a few weeks ago, I interviewed somebody all about molecular genetics, and so I just never get into it. But we're talking about SciComm, and we're talking about representation and bringing this information to people who maybe don't have access to it. So I just wanted to take a quick moment for anybody who's listening who happens to be an active science communicator or somebody who's interested in starting science communication or just dipping their toe into the water to see if it's something they want to do. And we're talking anything and everything, podcasting, blogging, writing books, writing journal, not journal articles, but popular science articles, illustrating even. I mean, especially speaking of super cool scientists, you know, one of our workshop leaders this year is going to be Rachel Ignatovsky, who I had on the show previously. And she wrote the book Women in Science. And, you know, it's not a coloring book. Yours is a coloring book, which means it's interactive, which is amazing. But her book also features a bunch of super incredible women in the science field. And there's just so much cool crossover in this area. I think we're starting to see a growing trend of wanting to celebrate these people. But anyway, I'm going on a tangent. If you are interested in attending SciComm Camp, you should visit SciCommCamp.com and learn all about it, because I know it sounds like it's for kids, but it's not. It's for grownups who are kids at heart, just like you and just like me. There's stargazing, there's s'mores, there's horseback riding, all that. But there's also so much good workshopping and breakout sessions on being a science communicator. And I think that we need more of that. So I have to ask you, Sarah, have you had the opportunity to do any sort of professional development in SciComm? It's such a new field, right? That I feel like most SciCommers are not trained in SciComm.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, so where I was with this program in Rhode Island, the EBSCOR program, I got to start doing some SciComm related work through what I did with them, with their outreach work. And then also I did some work as an undergraduate and then again as a master's student with the Metcalf Institute for Marine and Environmental Reporting based out of the University of Rhode Island. And actually their director, Dr. Sunshine Menezes, is in the second book as well. She's one of my personal mentors, so it's really kind of an honor for me to be able to sort of tell her story a little bit more. But Metcalf really started trying to sort of train journalists more on sort of the whole scientific process in order to sort of better communicate that, specifically focused on marine science at the time. But they've really expanded now to doing work also with the academic scientist as well. So sort of doing it from both sides, the journalism sort of media side, as well as the academic scientist researcher side, and really trying to get both sides to understand how the other one operates. And actually, coming up at the end of September, they have their first national conference that they're hosting actually at the University of Rhode Island called Inclusive SciComm. And so they've really expanded as a program since I worked with them as an undergrad nearly 10 years ago now.
Oh, very cool. And that's all about, I would guess, like representation within science and science communication?
Really seems to really be focused on the communication side of it. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. And that is so important, right? Because anytime a new field is establishing, it's fledgling, it's really just trying to get its legs. And then once it starts to get its legs, you start to realize that, oh gosh, there are so many kind of socio-political, psychological concerns within that field, sociological concerns within that field, like things like representation and diversity, the things that, you know, deeply matter to us if we're going to be effective science communicators and just if we want to be effective, you know, civic leaders or even participants. And so it's so great to see that movement into sort of social justice and diversity within the science communication field. Oh, that's really, really cool. So do you know, I mean, I know we're like plugging for other people. Oh, I just Googled it. Yay, Metcalf Institute.
Yeah.
So Inclusive SciComm.
They're accepting registrations right now. So it's still at the early registration discounted rate if you go look at it now and decide you really are interested. So they're still accepting registrations at this point for it. I'll be there actually selling the books.
Oh, great. Oh, that's so cool. And you know what? Before I want to take a quick break in just a second to thank the sponsors of the show. But before we do, where can people, you know, find your book? How can they get a hold of it?
Sure. So, I mean, certainly just typing Super Cool Scientist into Amazon will bring them up. But if you go to supercoolscientists.com, that's the website for more information about the project, how to get in touch with me, all of our social media links, and of course, the shop with the books and our t-shirts and things like that are available on that website.
Awesome. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode. All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, Army ROTC. Ready to become a leader? Enroll in Army ROTC. You could get a full tuition scholarship, and you'll graduate a leader and an officer in the U.S. Army. Army officers inspire strength in others. To receive more information about the Army ROTC program, visit goarmy.com/podcast today. Paid for by the United States Army. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, so we are back with Sarah McSorley, the author of Super Cool Scientists, a coloring book celebrating women in science, and the second installment, Super Cool Scientists. What's the subtitle of the new one again?
A story and coloring book celebrating today's women in science.
Today's women in science. And we thought, what better to do than offer a really great giveaway for you guys who are listening to the show. I'm going to assume that if you're listening to Talk Nerdy, you already follow me on Twitter at Cara Santa Maria, or maybe you follow Talk Nerdy at TalkNerdy_pod. But let's make sure that everybody who is listening right now has an opportunity to get a free bundle of both Super Cool Scientist coloring books. If you want to enter to win, all you've got to do is follow at Super Cool Sci. That's the Twitter handle for Super Cool Scientist. And let's pick a hashtag. What do you think? What should it be?
Let's do, I don't know, maybe Talk Nerdy Coloring.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so you're going to follow at Super Cool Sci, and you're going to tweet using the hashtag Talk Nerdy Coloring for a chance to win a bundle of both books shipped straight to you. Oh my gosh, how fun. Yay! I can't wait to see the results. Yeah, seriously, super cool. All right, so Sarah, you are doing this now full time, at least for the time being. Is it exciting? Is it scary? How are you feeling about it?
It's all of the above. So I think, you know, it's exciting because I feel like I'm at a point where it's a good decision to try that. So that says something. But it's terrifying just because it's totally different than what I've done for work before. Right. I think, sort of having your a regular 9-to-5 and sort of, you know, where your paycheck's coming from, like there's a certain comfort that comes with that, which is wonderful. And, you know, and I think I'd still like that eventually too. But for the time being, I was like, you know, this is moving along so well. And I actually was kind of in between jobs. So like I had the opportunity to really throw myself into this and really see what it was like to kind of push this a little bit more full time. So, and that's still pretty new. That really kind of started this summer. So it's still early in the process, which is terrifying in itself because it just hasn't been that long yet. I'm still getting used to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and there's so much to consider when you first kind of step out on this, in this area. Is it something that you anticipate or that you hope will become just kind of your ongoing full-time gig? Or are you also hoping to dive back into some of the educational or more forward-facing STEM work with a university or with an organization as well?
Right. So I think I want to be able to continue with writing this kind of work, at least in some way throughout my career, because I really enjoy it and I find it to be really important. But I think that part of what I want to do is I'm at this transition point where I have 10 years in higher ed, but I feel like I don't have a lot of growth potential yet for myself in higher ed. So what I really want to do eventually is to transition more into recruiting. So really sort of using that experience in higher ed and then this work sort of with, you know, inclusion work in science to really try to work for search firms that are working with these sort of STEM companies to really make sure the right people are getting into the right positions. And then part of that
really
too,
cool.
So some of it is the, you know, the search part of that is really getting the right people in the right positions, but also a lot of, you know, those search firms also do consulting work with organizations who are really trying to, you know, make their environments and their cultures more inclusive as well. So I feel like that's kind of the next step that could sort of be my next career trajectory, where I could really use all of the things that I bring to the table already and plus the things I'm passionate about. So I think eventually that's really what I want to sort of move into as more of a full time and then sort of have the writing just sort of be a side thing that goes along with all of it again.
And that's really cool because it's definitely something that has the freelancer component to it, right? This idea of, I guess, recruitment, consulting, maybe like, I don't know what the word is, headhunting. Isn't that kind of a thing?
Yeah, it is.
Call it?
Yeah.
I love that. And you know what? It really goes to show that if you are trained, whether it's in the sciences or any sort of related STEM fields, right? Technology fields, engineering fields, mathematics fields, and whether we're talking graduate level education or undergraduate level education, there are so many more opportunities than than research or then working towards getting tenure or being a professor. There are so many ways to use those skills that we've developed. And I think you and I are prime examples of that.
Yeah. And it's not always something that even necessarily comes to mind right away. You know, I think, and I was talking about this in the Her STEM Story podcast recently with an interview I did with them where, you know, so much of it is just figuring out how to pivot. And now that's one of those things, like for me, that was sort of a challenge, but also a really good skill to learn a little bit better, where if you're really thinking about what your skill sets are, that applies to a bunch more different types of jobs than just sort of a singular focus. And you think, oh, well, my degree is in this, or, you know, this is what I've done. That doesn't mean that you don't have other options. And I think, you know, part of the things that I've sort of gone through transition wise over the past few years, again, sort of personally and professionally, have made me think about some of those things differently than I had before. Where sort of everything happening at once kind of forced me to think about it differently, which turned out to be a really good thing because it wasn't a perspective that I would have had if I had sort of been in my same comfortable day to day that I was in. So I think sort of none of this stuff happens in a vacuum, right? Like our lives and our interactions and our relationships are so interconnected that you're kind of trying to figure out how to move all of them forward at the same time. And so sort of thinking about all those things together, it's not just about finding the next job. It's about finding the next job that really fits what I want my life to be.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I often kind of think of this analogy of holding something so tightly that you actually end up crushing it under your weight, that we tend to be taught, I think, and socialized to have a plan and stick with that plan and be, you know, linearly focused in just checking the boxes on the to-do list of how we're going to achieve our goals. And I think that, you know, for some people in some respects that can be really helpful, but ensuring that we have such a rigid mentality, I think, actually makes it so that we literally have blinders on for other opportunities that come our way. And, you know, being open to maybe walking through some doorways or, you know, taking some paths that don't seem that you never thought were legitimate opportunities, or that maybe were a little less trodden, going out on your own, trying something new. It can be really scary, but I think that for most people I interview, and I've now interviewed hundreds of people on this show, when I ask them how they got to where they are, especially people who have really cool jobs in the sciences or in SciComm or in journalism, like, how did you know, what was your path? They're always like, totally non-traditional, had an opportunity I never thought I would take, decided to go out on a limb and try it. And that's how I ended up where I am. It's so rare that people are like, yep, checked all the boxes and followed the path laid out in front of me. It just doesn't happen.
No, it's true. And I'm smiling over on this end because a lot of what you just said kind of goes along with a different writing project that I just sort of became a part of. There's a collection called 20 Beautiful Women, and they're on their sixth volume that they're getting ready to publish now. So, and it's totally not like the super cool scientist related writing. It's more my personal sort of story. These stories of individuals sort of empowering women who sort of how they've gotten through different things. And sort of, I'm going to have a chapter in that upcoming publication too, because it was one of these things over the past couple years between January and June of last year, I found out my job, my department was going to be closing where I was working. I got divorced and I got diagnosed with a chronic illness in a 6-month time frame. It was one of those things where the universe was just like, here you go, here's a reset on everything, you know. But there were also some incredible, like, good things that happened during that time too, you know, like both my parents got remarried to like fantastic partners. My brother and his fiance had a beautiful little girl. So I'm a niece. I'm an aunt for the first time the first niece that I've ever had. And she's perfect. And, you know, and sort of in doing some of the figuring out what I wanted to do next career-wise and sort of thinking, talking to some recruiters on my own, trying to find the right job, like that's how I discovered that recruiting would sort of really be a good path for me to take next. Like I wouldn't have necessarily thought about that unless I had been in that situation, right? So sort of all of those things ended up being a real positive for me because they kind of set me on the track that I needed to be on.
I love that. I mean, I just love hearing that story because I think it helps bring perspective that I know it's very hard for us to maintain when we're in it. Like when we really feel like we're in the shit, you know, the plan is broken. We had all of our ducks in a row and now they're getting out of the row. The job is canceled or the health insurance was lost or, you know, whatever the really stressful, frustrating, you know, depression inducing life circumstances bring our way. And, you know, it's such a bullshit trope, this idea of like, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. And sometimes we literally aren't in control of that. But in hindsight, seeing the opportunity that sometimes hardship brings up or the ability to shift perspective, right? Because you're in a new framework and you see, oh gosh, that's an aspect of my life I've been really not paying attention to. Or, oh goodness, you remember that thing that my friend was always hounding me about participating in and I just didn't have time because I was so overwhelmed with work. Now I'm going to go take that workshop and see what comes of it. Like these can sometimes be like literal pivot points in our lives.
Yeah. And I think, and that doesn't mean that, you know, you don't have days that are still totally miserable. Like, you know, even though, you know, challenges, I think are opportunities and that's definitely been true. It doesn't mean there haven't been days where I've eaten the whole pizza or haven't gotten my butt up off the couch from watching Netflix. Like, you know, those days still happen. But I think sort of, you know, overall, so much of it for me was sort of finding my joy again and, you know, realizing that even in the midst of all these transitions, which could be perceived as good, bad or otherwise, there's always joy to be had if you choose to seek that out. And like you said, a lot of it is just sort of, maybe picking up on things or taking a chance on things that you never thought you could before. So like for years, people have been telling me that I'm a good writer, but like I never thought that I could do that, right? Because I was like, no, I trained to be a scientist and then I trained to get my MBA. Like this is what I'm trained to do and what I'm going to do. And this is my trajectory and these are my check boxes and this is my checklist and this is what I do. That finally sort of paying attention to that and sort of paying attention to my own gut with some of that too. It's like, yeah. And now I've going to have, you know, 2 books in 2 years, which is pretty incredible. And people love them. So it's sort of been a good boost for myself too, to recognize that, you know, it's not just the science stuff or the project management stuff that I have to offer. Like I have these other pieces and these other skills too.
Oh yeah. And I think that just goes to show like a sort of a larger societal problem that a lot of, I think active psychommers are really trying to myth bust, which is this idea that there are left brain people and there are right brain people, which is such a fundamental myth, right? We all use all of our brains. Otherwise things would not be going as well as they are. And that, you know, science is a fundamentally creative endeavor. You know, we are not just, you know, women are not just socialized to be literary and men are not, well, they are socialized, but women do not only have literary skills and men do not only have engineering skills. And, you know, there's so much crossover between all of these things that I think sometimes, I don't know, I almost wish that there was some sort of rite of passage or some sort of academic or educational experience that we all go through that like forces us to do the opposite of the thing we think we're good at in order to see that it's not that scary. And it's not, and I get it. Cause I, you know, coming from the artistic perspective, I cannot draw to save my life. And I think I've stigmatized myself to thinking that I have literally no artistic ability, but it's mostly because I'm scared to try. I'm scared to try and I'm scared to fail.
Right. And I think some of it, and you just also get so used to what you're doing that you don't always see the other pieces. Like you kind of just get caught up in the status quo. So like, I remember when the original book came out, I was doing a talk in the hometown I grew up in with actually one of the girls who I grew up in. We were in school together and Girl Scouts together. And she was sort of running the programming at this art center at the time. And we were having a conversation and she was like, you know, I've always thought it was really interesting because you've always had this interest in not just science, but this interest in arts too. And it's really cool how you've been able to bring them together. And I really hadn't thought about that because I picked the science path to kind of go through and do my training. But she was right. Like, as a kid, when like we grew up, we were in art club together and we did all these art classes like outside of school together. And, you know, I had done all of that. And I think as I got older, you know, my art side came out more like in some jewelry that I got into jewelry making and then in my writing. But it's like, I didn't consider that sort of as evenly as I did what I was doing with the science side. It was always there, but it was like, I wasn't paying as close attention to it because it wasn't mm-hmm. what I thought the primary thing needed to be. But sort of, so really realizing that you can have both and both bring value, sometimes even to the other. So like with the second book, especially, there was some of this in the first one, but quite a few of the features actually really talk about how that's super important for them, not just their science and analytical work, but also their artistic work too, because at the base of all of it, like you said, is really about creativity. And sort of that's where you kind of hear this whole STEM to STEAM thing, like inserting the arts into science, technology, engineering, and math, because if you're using all of those things together, then maybe you're getting a better result.
You know what I have to say is one of my favorite parts of this book. You know, I obviously love that. And just for people, I think you've probably gathered it from us talking over the course of the hour. But in case if you haven't, basically each new page is a different scientist. And there's kind of a full page sort of bio information about her, you know, things that are important to know. And then there's a reverse page that's like a full coloring book page with an illustration of her, usually against some sort of really cool backdrop that places you in an understanding of the work that she does. So, but at the end of the book, and this is just like extra work that you did, but it's so important and I think meaningful. And it's the kind of thing that a lot of people overlook sometimes when they endeavor to read a book, is that you have a full list of resources, really incredible resources, you know, Black Girls Code, African American Women in Physics, Girls Who Code, National Museum of Mathematics, National Society of Hispanic Physicists, you know, a lot of really great, Vi-Hart's YouTube channel. I love Vi-Hart. So yeah, a lot of really great resources with a description of what they are, a list of really great books as well, some of which are by the women that are featured. And look, there's Rachel Ignatovsky's book. See,
right.
Crossover. Yeah. But then you also have this really great illustrated glossary that has all the kind of basic terms that I think we sometimes gloss over, where, you know, there is this necessary scientific lexicon. As SciCommerce, we always talk about, you know, try and avoid jargon, but there are basic jargon terms that are almost necessary just to have a conversation. And so being able to look those up while you're reading about these women and say, oh, I guess I don't really know what an environmental engineer is, or, you know, what is the difference between cognitive science and psychology, and being able to just, instead of having to pick up Google, see them all in the same resource. Gosh, I think that's super helpful and not enough books do it.
Thanks. I think, you know, part of thinking that through was, you know, originally thinking through the audience, the text was really geared at sort of upper elementary school, middle school aged kids. So, you know, not knowing what necessarily you've gotten to in school yet, kind of some more information there if you were interested in knowing more about some of the concepts, or where you could go to get more of that information, kind of providing a gateway into some of that. You know, and the resources list is certainly not, you know, everything that's out there. It's just a starting point, but I kind of wanted something that was there. And then through the feedback I've gotten, you know, that age group certainly enjoys the book, but younger children really like it too. But, you know, and the feedback from their parents and teachers, you know, they may not be doing the reading, they may be having it read to them, but they're still getting the message that, you know, women do this incredible work and that they can do this kind of work too. And I think, you know, the surprise audience for me was more of the adults and the college students. I think mm-hmm. the people who are really interested in, sort of the mission of the book in sort of changing this narrative to really highlight some of the people who are already doing this work, and that they are women and that they are people of color, and that they do exist and that you can do it too. Sort of that inspirational piece, you know, people who can really get behind that idea tend to be more of the college students and the adults. But so it's really got a broad range. And I think one of my favorite things is sometimes we get people who will send in their coloring pages when they're done, and sort of seeing the differences in interpretations of how people choose to color the pages. So it's, you know, it's interesting because as a coloring book, you know, the images are just black and white, like line drawings, right? Yeah. So there aren't a whole lot of indicators there. But a lot of times, especially with younger kids, they'll just draw the person to look like themselves. And that's really the whole point, right? Is that you can, like, you want young people to just be able to see themselves in these careers. So I love when I get a coloring page submitted to me to share that looks totally different than that person does in real life, because I think that that's kind of what it's all about, because we want people to be able to see themselves in these careers too.
Awesome. Yeah, no, completely. Oh, that just makes me so, I don't know, I get a little misty when I think about it. Especially just when I think about like young girls having a new world open up to them just because of access to things like this. Because again, I think about what it was like when I was a little girl. And I think that I went through this roller coaster of perspective when I was super young. We did this project in my kindergarten, I think it was, where we had these little paper doll cutouts and we were to glue little outfits onto them and, you know, dress them and kind of prepare them in such a way to show what it is we wanted to be when we grew up. And I still have mine and it says, you know, Dr. Santa Maria, paleontologist on her little name tag. And like, you know, I loved dinosaurs when I was a little girl, like most little kids do. And it just, it was incomprehensible to me that that wasn't something I could do. But then as I got a little bit older, I started to think, you know, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe this, you know, that's more of a dude's job. And I don't really see that many women doing this. And, you know, and I don't even think I could verbalize it. I think it was just sort of internalized in me. And I didn't rediscover science until I was a graduate student. You know, my undergrad was psychology, and I kind of found neuroscience as part of my maybe junior, senior year of psychology, but didn't really embrace it until my master's degree, because I didn't think it was for me. And I think this is such a common story for so many girls.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's part of the reason to show so many different types of careers, too, and also what they really include and look like. So like sometimes if you're thinking about as a kid, well, these are the types of things I'm interested. Maybe I want to do this, you know, like I really want to travel the world. So maybe I should be a travel agent or a travel blogger or, you know, something, or I should work on a cruise ship. But scientists get to travel all the time too. They get to travel all over the world, whether it's do their work or present at conferences. You know, so there are different ways to kind of talk about that too. And I think one of the things that we sometimes hear is that, you know, a lot of times girls and women want to go into work that really helps other people, and realizing that that's what a lot of science does too. Like, depending on how you're applying it, there's a lot of work out there that's also doing work that's there to, you know, not just help people, but help our planet. And, you know, so sort of depending on how you're talking about science careers, you know, that can be really helpful too in making it more accessible to people, especially girls.
You're so right. And so many science careers have a human component. Like, you know, I think we often think that scientists work alone. And there is a type of science you can do where, I mean, I did that kind of science where I was doing a lot of like dissections and seeding, you know, neuronal networks where it's like I'm working in the middle of the night with my headphones because I don't want to be distracted. And like, if that's for you, that's great. But that is not the only type even of laboratory science that's available. So much of science is interfacing with other people. It's working in groups. It's having mentor-mentee relationships and being really collaborative. But it's just not often presented that way.
Right. And I think that's sort of, you know, one of the pieces, too, besides just the scientists who are featured talking about their work. You know, I think in pretty much all the stories, there's sort of a connection to what these women then sort of give back, whether that's through mentoring students at the colleges they work at or doing larger projects, you know, outside of work or as part of larger projects, too. Like, I mean, Dr. Menezes, like I said, runs Metcalf, and that's all SciComm based. But there are other ones who do all this other outreach work that's really kind of meant to get more people excited about science and, you know, really bringing more people into it and telling more people what it's about. that I think that's important too. Like that is part of these people's day-to-day jobs, even if it's not in their job description. A lot of times we end up doing that anyway.
Absolutely. Well, gosh, Sarah, I mean, I have had so much fun chatting with you today, but I can't keep you all day. I wish I could. But before we go, I would love to ask you the final two questions, the same two questions that I ask everybody who I have on the show. And they're kind of big picture questions. So are you ready for that?
I am.
All right. So I want you to think about the future in whatever context is kind of important and relevant to you right now. And in doing so, I want you to tell us first, what is the thing that is most disconcerting to you? What keeps you up the most at night? You know, what are you most worried about? But on the flip side of that, what are you kind of realistically and honestly excited and optimistic about?
Yeah. So I think in thinking about these questions before today, you know, really sort of the diversity and inclusion work that I'm trying to do through Super Cool Scientists, the part that kind of keeps me up at night is that in a lot of ways, we're further behind on that than maybe sometimes we feel like we should be. Mm-hmm. And like in my sort of very recent personal sphere, I've been dealing with realizing, you know, some people close to me, like some more issues of racism that I didn't realize were there. So it's been much more of a conversation and it's kind of made me think about things a little bit differently in a lot of ways. So I think that, you know, and just sort of stories of women in science, the things that I went through, the things that a lot of professional colleagues and friends are continue to go through, sort of those challenges. I think it really just is a kind of a question of like, how long is it going to take us to actually get there? And that's kind of nerve wracking in a way. But yeah. I think, you know, in doing this work through the Super Cool Scientist books too, sort of hearing about how so many women deal with those things and sort of want to share with others so they don't have to deal with them as much. And all of the people and organizations who are out there right now, I think really working to try to make things more inclusive and recognizing it's not just about recruitment and getting butts in seats. It's really about the representation and the sort of the retention as well, which is really all about, you know, creating the environments where everyone does feel like they're welcome and valued and have the same kind of access. So I think sort of we're on the right track. And in talking to a lot of the people I've gotten to meet through this project, you know, all of that makes me really hopeful that we'll get there sooner rather than later.
Oh, I love it. Well, gosh, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today. Guys, the books, plural, are Super Cool Scientists, books 1 and 2. I want to remind you that if you would like to enter into a giveaway for a free pack of both books, all you have to do is follow Super Cool Scientists on Twitter. And again, that's Super Cool Sci, and use the hashtag. What did we decide on?
Talk Nerdy Coloring.
Yes, Talk Nerdy Coloring. And there will be a winner selected at random who will receive both books. So, and again, you can check it out at itssupercoolscientist.com, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Awesome. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me. I had an absolute blast.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.